Welcome to Embargoed, intelligent talk about sanctions, export controls, and all things international trade for trade nerds and normal human beings alike. I'm your host, Tim O'Toole, and with me today, and I'm very happy to have him here today, is Eric Ferrari of Ferrari Associates. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So I'm very excited to have you, and the part of the reason I'm excited to have you is we're going to talk about delisting today, and there really is not anybody in Washington or anybody in the world, really, that I would rather talk with delisting about than Eric. Eric is really, I would say, the foremost delisting expert in the world, and we'll talk over the course of the podcast about exactly what that means. So Eric, welcome. And why don't you talk a little bit about just the listing process, you know, how you get on a list and kind of what, you know, where your role comes in and kind of what your practice does in connection with listing.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for the opportunity to do that. You know, I started working on delisting cases right out of law school. So it was some of the first legal work I've done. And the reason why that's relevant to your question is because I've really seen things morph over the years. You know, things always change from administration to administration. But when you've been doing it through Bush to Obama to Trump and to now Biden, you can really kind of track the trends and what's changed there. So let's talk a little bit about how you get on the list. You can be put on the sanctions list if the Office of Foreign Assets Control at the Department of Treasury or the State Department under certain authorities has developed a reasonable cause to believe that you have engaged in some conduct or meet some status which matches with the designation criteria contained in a particular executive order or in certain limited scenarios in a certain statute. Now, these agencies that would sanction you, they can obtain information from any source. It could come from public reporting. It could come from domestic law enforcement intelligence investigations, foreign law enforcement and intelligence investigations, people walking into an embassy and giving information. So there's a whole broad range of information that they can rely on.
Let me just stop you there. So basically, I just want to kind of loop back around for the people who are not, you know, as conversant in this stuff. So first off, when you're talking about the lists, we're talking about the OFAC SDN lists, and there's multiple of those lists. I think usually they're referred to as one, but we're talking about getting on the list through targeting, and you're talking about kind of them putting you on there. I assume part of this, what you're going to talk about, is kind of the process or lack of process for going on the list.
Yeah, that's right. We're talking about the Consolidated Specially Designated Nationals and Blocked Persons list that's administered by the United States Department, the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control. There are kind of components of the list or divisions within the list. But yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. So what we're really saying when we're talking about getting listed is being identified amongst other individuals, entities, and organizations who have been targeted pursuant to U.S. economic sanctions programs, and in a lot of cases, not all cases, have been blocked. In other words, their assets have, under U.S. jurisdiction, have been frozen. There are certain prohibitions on dealing with them.
And just to stop you there, so the frozen meaning it's still their money, it's still their assets, but they can't do anything with them. And in they're entitled to interest on those assets. They continue to accumulate. So as a property matter, and I think this is part of the design, nothing has been taken by the U.S. government and nothing has been taken by the blocking. It's just kind of frozen in place while you earn interest, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it could be anything. It could be funds in an account. It could be a piece of real property. It could be a contract. So the blocking is on any property or interest in property that falls under U.S. jurisdiction.
Yep. Yep. And so essentially you've gotten to the point where something is blocked, and just talk a little bit about kind of how you find out that your property has been blocked, if your property has been blocked.
Sure. I mean, it could be anything from turning on the news one day and seeing that you've been identified as a sanctioned person. I've heard from clients, someone sent me a message on Facebook and said you're sanctioned. So it's not as if they send you a formal letter you usually find out through open source. And it's funny, I've had clients who have been on the list for a week or so and have had family members who called and said, you know, how's this impacting you? And they said, what are you talking about? And, oh, well, you're on the sanctions list.
Right. And talk a little bit about kind of the reasons that they give you for putting on the sanctions list, if any, because they don't send you a letter.
Right.
Do they give you any reasons?
No, the reasons are pretty much only stated in the press release announcing the designation. And they could, in some cases, they can be extensive. They might have a lot of open source information that allows them to put additional information into the press release. But a lot of times it's, well, this person provides supportive services to senior Russian officials and has close relationships with them. And, you know, it'll be one sentence or a couple sentences.
They're really can you find out more? Can you go to OFAC and say, well, I'd like a little more information about why I was listed so I can respond to it?
You can find out more. There's two ways. You can make a request directly to the Office of Global Targeting. There is no, that I'm aware of, any regulatory framework under which that request is made. But traditionally, as a matter of practice, the Office of Global Targeting at OFAC will, in response to a request for the administrative record, these are the reasons and evidence they relied on, will send you an unclassified copy of the administrative record. And or you can also request it pursuant to the Freedom of Information Act, and you can seek it that way. In either way, though, you're not going to get it tomorrow. You're going to get it, you know, a year, 18 months, sometimes 2 years from now.
And what you get, do you often get kind of the full record, or do you get, I mean, I'll ask a leading question. Do you get kind of a 50-page record or a 100-page record, you know, 99% of which is redacted?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And some, you don't get much in there outside of what's already contained in the press release. It really depends on the program. So it's actually interesting when you look at some of like the global Magnitsky designations, or you look at like the DRC designations, there's a lot more public reporting on the particular targets. So you might have NGO reports, media reporting, and things like that in there. But traditionally, we don't get a whole lot of information. So you might have a 500-page record, and there are only, you know, 50 or 40 or 50 pages of, you know, substantive information.
So somebody comes to you, and they've been put on the list, and you don't have much information about why they're on there. Talk a little bit about kind of the first client meeting and kind of how that goes and what you tell them about. Kind of, how are we going to get off the list?
Right. First, the thing I tell them is that this is very hard. Okay. The delisting process is simple, but not easy. That's my standard line, because it is simple, but it's not easy. And it's going to take a long time. I know that other people have said, you know, it only takes a couple months, or, you know, if you have the right contacts, it can move very quickly. Look, there's always outliers. But traditionally, if you're going into this process, it's going to be difficult. It's going to take time. And when I say time, I'm talking 2 years plus. And there's a lot of traps in the process. And I think what people miss in this process is they think, you said I did something bad, so now I need to let you know I'm good. And that's not the process at all. Keep in mind what OFAC's standard is, reasonable cause to believe. It's not about whether you actually did the thing or meet the status. It's about whether they have any reason to believe that you could. They have a concern about you. And so what I tell clients is, look, we can jump into the facts and you can give me all your defenses and all the reasons why this is terrible and OFAC's wrong. None of that at the end of the day really matters. What really matters at the end of the day is how we can, one, identify what their sourcing of information is and attack the credibility of that sourcing. And that's an important point I want to come back to later. But two, what are we going to propose to address their concerns and assuage those concerns? And really, to understand that third point, you need to understand the delisting regulation. So what the delisting regulation says is that there are essentially three pathways to remove a designation, which is, one, you can show there was an insufficient basis for the designation. Either there's a factual or legal mistake.
Which is hard, since they haven't given you the basis for the designation.
Right. Correct. Yeah. And you don't know what their sources are or even what those sources have said. Two, you can assert a change in circumstances to those circumstances which gave rise to the designation. I think that's an important point to keep in mind.
Yep.
Or three, you can make a proposal of remedial measures, which if adopted would negate the basis of the designation. And so what I tell clients all the time is to sit back and take yourself out of this moment and the emotions of this moment and think about how often does the US government admit that it got something wrong, right? So like this idea that you're going to go in and say, hey, National Security Enforcement Agency, right? Because that's what OFAC is. It's a law enforcement agency that operates in this national security context. You made this big mistake that has said all these terrible things about me. I'm a terrorist, or I'm a corrupt actor, or I'm, you know, an arms dealer, whatever it is. You made a mistake. I'm actually a great person, and you need to go back and take that decision back.
It's a hard road to hoe, especially if you can't find out what their sources of information were.
Exactly. And so what I tell clients from the beginning is like, look, here's the deal. We can go take the uphill battle, and I'll walk that uphill battle with you, and we'll do our best. But if you really want to get this done, what you need to do is you need to assess what could have led them to believe this. And two, come up with a proposal to address those allegations. And I'm not asking the client to admit to anything or to concede to anything. What I'm asking the client to do is identify what measures you can take to make them feel comfortable that you're not doing this thing now and you won't do it in the future.
Yep. You know? Yep. And so it kind of blends in. I mean, a little part of maybe all of your information wasn't right, and whether it was right or not, here's the situation on the ground now, because that way it gives them an out, right? I mean, you're giving OFAC or the government an out to say, look, we still think we were right, but we agree that this is the situation on the ground now. And if that had been the situation on the ground before, we wouldn't have designated you. So, you know, you'll be off with some terms most likely. And I assume that's probably where you're going next with respect to remedial measures.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I would say too is, you can have great evidence as to why you didn't do it, but it doesn't matter. We've turned over a lot of good evidence in cases where OFAC says, we don't have a problem with your evidence, but we have our own evidence, and it shows you did meet the basis for designation. So it's not like a competing, it's not like a competition between evidence. It's only if their evidence is credible.
Right. I mean, and that is really, to me, that I find the hardest part about a delisting process is that in, at least theoretically, in the criminal justice process, you kind of know what the government's evidence is. And certainly after you've sat through a trial, you know what it is, and you have the ability to respond to it. In the, you know, the listing process and, you know, the corresponding delisting process, you kind of don't know what you're up against. So even if you kind of put on this case to show all sorts of things are happening, you don't know if you've responded to everything that they have, because you don't know what their information is. And I think that's why it's just so hard to come in and show an insufficient basis, because you don't usually know the basis.
Yeah, 100%. And I'll make it just a little bit worse than that, which is you don't know their evidence, and the same jury that basically designated you is the one reviewing your delisting petition. So it's not even like a third party is looking at this, you know, on their own and independently. You're going back to the same folks who sanctioned you and saying, hey, I don't think you're right. And the way I've described it, and this kind of gets into the remedial measures to clients, but the way I've described it is you have to give OFAC a win, and then you have to force them to take it. So step one is just identifying how they won. And then step two is now the advocacy piece, which is convincing them that they have won.
Yep.
And that's actually the hard part, because there's a lot of considerations that go into this. From the government side that aren't necessarily, you know, have we checked the boxes that they're no longer doing this? Because what I was going to say is a lot of times, you know, there's an interagency consultation process, right? And so you might not want, OFAC might not want to take a party off the list because there's a DOJ investigation that could be impacted, or a DOJ prosecution.
Right. And that's where I was heading, is that OFAC, at least in my experience, and I'm going to frame this as a question, but it's not always the decider. That is, OFAC listed you because they're the ones with the authority to do that, but they may have listed you because another agency wanted you listed, or they may have listed some property because another agency wanted you listed. And so even if you convince OFAC that there's no there, if there's another agency involved, you're going to actually have to try and figure out what that agency is and convince that agency either directly or indirectly through OFAC what it is that whatever it is that caused the listing is either, you know, was didn't exist in the first place or has gone away. I mean, and is that a dialogue that you have a lot? I mean, when you're dealing with OFAC, are you often dealing directly or indirectly with some of the other agencies that might be involved?
Yeah, so this is probably going to get me canceled after this podcast, but I'll dive into this a little bit. It really depends, but look, you're exactly right. There's other agencies involved, and OFAC gets too much blame for flaws in the process, because a lot of times it isn't, you know, they're just going with what the interagency is objecting to, and that's how they're responding. But I'll give you two different scenarios, because in one hand, if you have a parallel DOJ investigation or prosecution that is somehow influencing or tied to the designation, that's actually more resolvable, because you can go to the prosecutors or the agents and say, listen, you know, let's resolve this investigation or this prosecution. And that, while that won't inherently lead to the removal of the designation, it's certainly a material consideration of OFAC to whether or not a designation should be removed. On the other hand, when you have the State Department coming in and providing foreign policy guidance that might be influencing the decision, they won't talk to you. I know, because right. I've tried. And right. This is the part where I get canceled. But, you know, we've reached out to the State Department and said, listen, we know that you guys will provide foreign policy guidance with respect to our delisting petition before OFAC. So can you please provide us that guidance so we know what your expectations are for our client to conform their behavior to those expectations? And they'll just respond, you need to talk to OFAC about it. And then you'll ask OFAC and they just won't either answer you, or they'll say, you know, we're not, you know, you're not entitled to that. But you can't really get the guidance you need to do the thing they want you to do, which is change the behavior of the sanctions target, which is very
right. I mean, this gets back to, I think, a lot of people's big frustration with this whole listing process is that you're listed. They're not really telling you the reasons. You come in and you say, well, I want to figure out whether there's a sufficient basis so I can either allege that there's an insufficient basis or I can acknowledge that there's a sufficient basis and move on to whether or not the circumstances have changed or whether there's remedial measures. And you kind of don't know what your goal is, or you don't know what the basis is. You really, it's a moving target, and or at least a target that you never get access to, which doesn't seem to fit the notion of at least traditional notions of due process. Can you talk a little bit about how the courts have looked at kind of these sorts of due process issues? Because you'd think that in the United States, they don't do things to you until without notice and an opportunity to be heard and to see what the evidence is against you and respond to it. Talk a little bit about how courts have kind of come into this process.
I'm definitely going to do that, but I got to go back to your target point.
And okay, please.
Because I would actually argue there is no target. Right. Because there have been plenty of conversations I've had with OFAC about what is your objective here? What do you want from this person? And they say, I don't know. What are you proposing? Right? And so you can ask them. And there's a great example. Let me just give you this example, and then we'll go to the due process stuff in the courts. But the DRC program, Democratic Republic of Congo program, has been in place for 18 years. 74 people have been designated under that program. One person has been removed because he died. So the basis, and it's not for want of trying. I know, because I've represented 13 of those those 74.
Well, and that, I mean, that does get back, and we will move to the due process in courts in a second, but it gets back to kind of the basis and what is the purpose of sanctions. And I think at least from a theoretical legal standpoint, OFAC and the Treasury Department have said, this is not a punishment. This is not a taking of property. We're not depriving anyone of property because they have their property. They just can't use it. So essentially, it's not a punishment. It's not a taking. It's basically just a measure that we're using, a carrot, to reward you for when you change your behavior. Theoretically, that sounds great. And that, I think, is the legal framework for sanctions. But how can you change your behavior if you don't know how they want you to behave? I mean, I think that's really the challenge for sanctions policy generally is, why won't they tell you what you're supposed to do if the whole point is to get you to change your behavior?
Because they don't know themselves. They don't have a policy with respect to each target. They, a lot of times, don't have a delisting policy with respect to each program. They don't know. They'll put you on the list.
And I say this a lot. I mean, our friends at OFAC are trying their best. Like, this is a system that they didn't create, that they work very hard. They're overburdened. They're people who act in good faith. But it is a weird system where you essentially put someone on a list and tell them that they need to change their behavior in order to get off the list. And then they won't, no one seems to know what it is that you're supposed to do in order to get off the list.
No, 100%. Yeah, none of this is meant as a shot to OFAC, because actually I think OFAC does try really hard to get it right. And it's funny because people ask me, they're like, well, what are they like over there? And I'm like, it's a bunch of very smart, nice people, but the institution and the apparatus for delisting is just inherently flawed.
Right.
And it's not any one agency or one person's fault. It's not. It's just the way it works, from my perspective, doesn't work.
Well, and that was kind of when I was heading off to this question about due process in the courts.
Right.
For the most part, I mean, our system of government is based on a separation of powers. Like, one party does X, and then there's another party within the government that can check them and do Y. And so usually when the executive branch acts, the courts review their actions, and so it kind of constrains them to act within particular, you know, the courts don't like to micromanage, but the courts kind of give them some guide rails and say, as long as you're within the guide rails. Has that been your experience with judicial review of OFAC? And if not, kind of talk about a little bit how, or if so, talk a little bit about how that makes it hard for any agency to have accountability.
Yeah, not in the targeting context. So the courts have checked OFAC a couple times in the enforcement context. Look at the Exxon case and Epsilon Electronics. There was some pushback from the circuit, at least to some of the apparent violations that were imposed in that case. But in the targeting context, not only no guardrails, no speed limit, if you want my opinion. I mean, there's been a few opinions. I don't want to come off as the bitter and jealous delisting lawyer here, but there's a couple.
But I think from the, just looking at it from the outside, and I mean, I do a bit of this stuff as well, and I've litigated in all sorts of different other contexts, and I do see this kind of as one where the courts seem to have the most hands-off attitude. You know, you start with these wildly broad categories for designation, right? Operating in a sector of an economy in a country, I mean, like, thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of companies and individuals would meet that standard. And then OFAC basically just picks out whichever ones they want and won't tell you why it is that they picked from one from another, which outside of this context, I think U.S. courts would say that's very dangerous because that's just so much discretion and it seems unreviewable. But in the OFAC standpoint, I mean, many of the cases that I've seen say, well, you know, you're within that category and OFAC was operating within that category. What's the problem? And I think part of it is, at least looking from the outside, is this kind of view from the courts that OFAC is making national security determinations and making determinations that are not like most other agencies are making. And that's true to a point, but the sort of discretion that OFAC has, in my view, I don't know of any real analog in the U.S. government, whereas you've got an executive branch agency that makes determinations based on essentially no standards, and then there's no judicial review of those determinations that they make.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And what the courts have said is that in this intersection of national security, foreign policy, and administrative law, not only does OFAC have to be afforded deference, as all executive agencies are under this APA standard of review, they have to be provided extreme deference. So essentially, here's what you got, Tim. Let's put it all together.
Yep.
Okay. You've got a reasonable cause to believe standard. The courts have said there's no requirement for OFAC to verify or corroborate the information in their possession. They can rely on any evidence that comes into their possession. the courts will not substitute their judgment of the evidence for that of the agency. The courts are only looking at whether there's an arbitrary and capricious agency action here, which means that the agency didn't provide a reasonable explanation about how its evidence rationally connects to their legal authority. And the courts are doing that assessment under a standard of extreme deference.
Yeah.
So if anyone ever wants to fault me for losing a case, please keep in mind what I'm dealing with here.
It's like you have a competition, and we'll just analogize it to football. OFAC generally starts on the 6-inch line. And, you know, if they score, it's on you.
Yeah.
And you got to go 99 yards and 2.5 feet in order to march down the field. It's not a fair fight. Or, you know, if you want to talk about football, as most of our friends around the world would know football, you start down 10-0 and you're told, you know, here's, you know, go play a fair match and see if you can come back.
Right, and they've got Messi, Ronaldo, and you know all the greats on that side, and you know we got the junior varsity team. So,
exactly.
You know, not that I'm the junior varsity team. I'm saying
those. No, you're the A team, but you're not. It's not a fair fight.
Well, yeah, and look, and you know, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation if the process hadn't worked at some point, because we have removed people. That's why we have a reputation for delisting work. But it's
completely.
Really,
yeah. It's really hard, and it's set up in a way that is designed to prevent that result from happening. It still happens, but when it does, yeah, it's kind of a miracle.
It does. I want to go back to this punishment point, if we could, because this is fascinating/frustrating to me. So, you know, it's long been said sanctions are not punishment. They're to coerce a change in behavior. We've had cases, and this is public. You can look it up on the court docket in the Canton Tima v. Gackey, now v. Smith case. But, you know, the State Department provide guidance, which essentially said that maybe that was the wrong case. There was a case in the DRC context. It might have been a different one. Anyways, the point is, in the State Department case, they didn't want to remove the party because they said that a removal now, regardless of any role he continues to have in the government or doesn't have, would show that sanctions are short-lived. And such, we don't want to remove them now because then we'll lose the deterrence effect if we take it off. That sounds like punishment to me, right? Like, you changed the behavior, or at least there's some acknowledgement that you might have changed the behavior, but it doesn't matter because you haven't been on the list long enough. That's
right. We're making an example out of you.
Right, and OFAC's fallback on that is, well, look, you know, the State Department can say whatever it wants, just consulting us. We made the decision on other grounds, but I mean, it's in their consideration when they're making the decision. So it sounds punitive.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things that happen in this context sound relatively punitive. I mean, if you really are trying to change behavior, you really would be much more upfront, even if it's sanitized. I understand the national security implications. I understand that targeting is making decisions based on things that are correctly classified information. But you could still, at a high level, tell people why it is that they are on the list and what they could do to change the behavior if your goal is essentially to change behavior. And when you refuse to do that, it creates the appearance that you don't care about change behavior, that you're just doing this and whatever the consequences, that's just going to be somebody else's problem, and you don't really care about changing them, even if the behavior changes.
And that's such an important point, and I've reiterated this to OFAC many times. With the first 18 months to 2 years that someone's on the list, it's been my experience that they're willing to do whatever it takes to come off the list. They will bend over backwards for the U.S. government, but after a few years, when they figure out how to live under sanctions, it becomes less important for them. So if you're really trying to achieve something through a designation, if you're the more transparency we can have as to what do you actually need to see from this person, that's a win for the U.S. government. It really is. And, you know, one of the things that I've also heard is that OFAC takes delisting really seriously, which is good to hear, but for a different reason than I had thought, which is they take it really seriously because if they get it wrong, the consequences could be so dire. And I just think that's kind of a little bit divorced from what we see in our practical experience, because it's not like someone comes off the list and the next day they open up a bank account and take a $100 million line of credit from HSBC or something like that. Like, they have a really hard time even after they're delisted.
On one of the cases where I've gotten somebody off the list, we spent 3 years trying to get money out of a bank account that everybody agreed, I mean, OFAC agreed, that should be released. And it took 3 years to actually get the money back. And so it's not like when they snap their fingers that all of the consequences of the, you know, the listing go away and people can go back to their, you know, whatever they were doing beforehand. I mean, but even more so, there's a lot of listings, I think, and I'm sure it's not the majority and maybe even not, you know, a high percentage, but there's enough that I've definitely seen this pattern where people are, you know, they're not ultra wealthy. And in fact, they are what most people would view as middle class, maybe upper middle class. The effect of the listing on those folks is usually just extremely detrimental because, you know, with the ultra wealthy, banks will usually figure out a way if there's no connection to the U.S. and they can safely navigate U.S. sanctions. With people who have fewer resources, it's so much easier to just essentially, you know, de-risk with respect to those people. And they essentially go off grid and they don't have the resources to really go and do anything, certainly in economies that are, you know, U.S. facing. So if you live in Europe, for example, and you get put on the list and you were making $100,000 a year before the list or whatever the equivalent is in euros, and you get put on the list, it is an economic death sentence to those folks. And a lot of them, even if they wanted to, couldn't go back to the same behavior because they're just kind of out of whatever that role was. And no matter how hard you can prove that this person has changed behavior and is no threat to the U.S., the process is so slow and the process is so, you know, careful that those people really never have a chance because they just, you know, they just kind of fall out. And that's those are the cases that I think to me are the hardest because they just don't have the resources to fight. They don't have the resources to convince OFAC that there's changed behavior. They never were all that dangerous to begin with. And now that they're kind of out of whatever industry they were usually in beforehand, they're no threat to the United States, and yet they stay on the list for years and years and may never get off.
Yeah, no, 100% right. And even if they do get off, back to that point, it might not be the end of the story for them and the consequences.
Right. No, if once they get off, they still, you know, getting back into their bank accounts, convincing an employer that they're, you know, they with a U.S. nexus that they can now hire them, all of that stuff becomes essentially, you know, if not impossible, pretty impractical.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, and
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, that's one of the difficulties that we have here. And that's why our work actually starts in some cases, even before a listing, if we get a sense, someone might be designated, but then the listing, and then we have a whole bunch of follow-up work after the listing for all those reasons.
Yeah. And that's, and that was actually partly what I wanted to get at, but there is an entire investigative angle to this because especially if part of your job is to convince OFAC that there's not a sufficient basis, investigating these cases becomes critical. Can you talk a little bit about kind of some of the difficulties investigating these cases and then kind of some of the ways that you've overcome those difficulties?
Sure. So, I mean, one thing we talked about already was the sourcing, right? So you don't know what you actually need to investigate. The second is a lot of these targets are in foreign countries. They don't have the same level of sophistication with respect to record keeping within the country, much less with respect to the particular client. So that you then might not maintain adequate records. Communicating U.S. government standards and expectations in a foreign language, even if you're using or working through foreign counsel, that can be difficult. Time zones, making sure people are all coordinated and you're getting the most out of your conversations. There's a whole level, another level of just practical difficulty with respect to investigating these cases before you even get into the meat and the substance of the investigation and try to discern where the stuff has come from. And so what we do here is we kind of try to reverse engineer OFAC's designation. And we first start with what's in open source, right? Okay, what has been said? Who posted something on Twitter? Who said something in an NGO report? And we try to figure out where are the sources of information coming from. And then a lot of times our first move is to reach out to those journalists or those people at Think Tank and say, like, where are you getting this stuff? Right? Why do you believe this about our client? And, you know, is there any way we can talk to you to see if we can develop information that would address the allegations that you yourself have raised? I got to be honest, no one really wants to talk to us because they're like, oh, this is the bad guy's lawyer. But, right, you know, that's a necessary step in the process. And then from there, we just have to go into identifying what we can and how we can rebut it and how we can say, look, this is factually just not true.
Yeah. And I think these cases, to me, are some of the hardest to investigate. Back in the day, I used to represent clients who'd been sentenced to death and go back and try and do these investigations years after the fact. And those were often tough, but in many ways, these are tougher because of the even greater cultural differences, the time zone differences, the logistics differences, and then the difficulties in finding out what you're looking for, right? So you have to figure out what information caused the client to get designated, and how do we go back and figure out whether or not that's credible, not credible, reliable, not reliable. It is really hard. And then when you factor in that this is often 8, 9, 10, 11 hours away, so even doing it by Zoom, which is, you know, better than it used to be, is still really hard. And then if you wind up having to go there, which is usually the best way to investigate, it becomes 10 times harder because it's just a long trip, and then you have language difficulties once you're there, and actually investigating in some of these countries becomes difficult. So it's mostly just talking with clients and trying to get whatever documents that the client has. And it's a real lift to actually figure out what's going on in these cases. And then once you do, you've got all these standards that we talked about to meet.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I've been tired for the last 17 years that I've been doing this stuff. So I mean, it's because of all the traveling and Zoom calls late at night or early in the morning, which I'm sure you more than have an appreciation for.
Yes.
But yeah, it's difficult. It really is. And that's why I go back to clients. This is about remedial measures. And really, at the end of the day, OFAC is about compliance work. And this is compliance work.
Yep.
You know, and it's about identifying what are the problems and how can we correct them? And then how can we pitch OFAC that, hey, we've got a solution to address your concerns and move on? Because otherwise, you're going to be dealing with this for 5, 6, 7, 10 years or longer. And likely, even if you have good information, and this is something I want to go to in a second, too, but even if you have good information, they don't have to buy it. Like, we've had cases where, you know, the client, OFAC said, well, your client's involved in this business, and so is this other guy who's a sanctioned person. So they're probably working together. Okay. We went and got the corporate register, and we're like, our client's not a shareholder on his company. He has no shares, no interest in this company. He doesn't know what you're talking about. And OFAC's like, well, you know, he's not telling the truth because he's probably holding his shares through one of these other people. So it's like, you can't, like, how are you going to win? And then you go to a court, and a court's like, oh, it checks out, makes sense to us. We don't want to disturb their assessment. They're the expert.
It's good enough for government work.
Right.
So let's say, you know, you get information. Do you always file a petition, or do you sometimes get on the phone and say, like, do we need to file a petition, or, you know, tell me how that works, the difference between the formal process, which is obviously filing a listing application, and whether there is an informal process that can either speed it up or tell you, hey, don't even bother, this isn't going anywhere.
I would say 95% of the time it's a formal delisting petition, because we want to at least get something in the record. Sometimes OFAC won't even talk to you in a meeting or on a phone unless you've got a case open. Depending on the circumstances, there have been opportunities where we said, look, the facts and circumstances here support us having an informal conversation. Maybe there was some sensitive information involved. Maybe it's somebody who, you know, had something that was highly valuable but time sensitive to offer as a remedial measure. But I would say those are the exceptions, not the rule. And look, I don't just call OFAC or email OFAC because I don't want to expend any goodwill I might have left with them, none after this podcast, but
But no, we're working on it. We're going to rehabilitate. We're going to rehabilitate this at the end.
Right? But I don't want to, like, you know, waste their time and just say every time one of my clients is listed, you got to talk to me and we got to work it out informally. I try to go through the process as much as I can.
Yeah. I mean, that's been my experience too, is that the informal mechanisms only work if you've got something really unusual it's really not even appropriate sometimes for a delisting application. It's sensitive information that you would never write down, but you could share it with them and they might be interested in it. Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about kind of how the criminal process works in connection with OFAC? I mean, because often there is this overlap because, you know, all sanctions violations, if committed willfully, can potentially be criminal violations. How, just as a ballpark figure, how often do you see DOJ involved in this process, and how often is it just, you know, pretty clearly just a sanctions case?
Yeah, I would say maybe 20% of cases are tied to some ongoing criminal investigation or prosecution. Traditionally, it's been with respect to Iran or some counterterrorism authorities, every once in a while with Venezuela. And, you know, they always tell you, well, the two things are completely separate. Oh, and it happens, I'm sorry, a lot with counter narcotics, too, of course.
Right.
But they always tell you that things are completely separate. OFAC does its thing. DOJ does its thing. Look, the reality is if you are being prosecuted by DOJ and you come in with the world's greatest delisting petition, OFAC is still going to say no because DOJ is going to object. And so, and OFAC will view it as, well, you haven't gone through this prosecution. You haven't turned yourself in and, you know, fought the charges. Therefore, you're just not credible. So we can't believe anything you say. And that's how they kind of get out of it, even where you have solid arguments. So I would say about 20% of cases, we got some DOJ component. And, you know, while DOJ doesn't control the day, they're certainly very influential and a big part of the day in those discussions about whether delisting is appropriate or not.
All right. Well, that's kind of the lay of the land in terms of the questions that I have. Is there anything else you want to talk about in connection with delisting?
I actually want to talk about just real quickly about the potential for not getting listed at all. Because this is something that's very interesting. It's something that we've done over the years. From what I understand, we are one of the first firms to try it. And successfully, we've tried it successfully. But, you know, parties in 2024, parties who are going to get sanctioned can kind of divine and read the tea leaves and see, all right, I'm going to get sanctioned. This NGO is writing about me. You know, Bloomberg is writing about something's going on. I'm hearing stuff from people who were at the embassy or whatever. It happens all the time. And there's actually, it's not a formal process. There's no regulatory framework to do this. But what we know is under the Administrative Procedure Act, that if an agency is going to undertake an action, it has to account for all information in its possession, including information that's exculpatory. And so what we have seen clients successfully do, and in some cases unsuccessfully do, is go to OFAC before anything happens in terms of a designation and say, listen, I know you guys can't tell me if I'm being investigated for sanctions or not, but I know this stuff is being reported about me. And if you were to rely upon this information, that could potentially be considered sanctionable. And here's why this reporting is wrong, or why the circumstances are outdated, or hey, maybe there's some truth to this, but here's how I'm ready to remediate my conduct and work with you. And OFAC will have to take that information and they will have to consider it. And they'll have, if they're going to discount that information, they will have to provide their explanation for doing so in the administrative record. It makes it much more difficult for them to sanction you, and it can be a pathway to prevent from getting on the list and ever having to call me in the first place.
No, I think that's great, great advice. And I will say, I mean, it kind of relates a little bit to the one area that I think is worth drilling down on a little. I mean, I've had clients who were the subject of, you know, after there is a delisting application or in connection with a licensing application, OFAC often comes back with questions of its own. And I've had clients who were the subject of those questions. And once we found out that we were the subject of those questions, we did exactly what you're talking about. And so those questions are pretty common, but they also can be quite helpful in letting you know kind of what OFAC is thinking when you hear this information. And we've heard about the questions and gone in to say, hey, we heard you wanted to, know some information about us. We're here. We're happy to help. Tell us what you'd like to know, because we don't think we did anything wrong. And so I think it's great advice to get out in front of these things in the right cases. And for me, those are the cases where I think often reaching out without any sort of filing has been at least successful in the sense that it's gotten attention and even invited a filing. So, you know, after, but it's allowed you to preview it and also try and get ahead of this issue before the listing happens. So you don't have to place that call to Eric saying, "Hey, my friend just told me on Facebook I'm on the list. And what do I do to get off?"
Yeah, no, exactly. And it goes back to that key point. This is all about compliance. And so just as you would, if it was a compliance exercise and you were identifying where your exposure was and remediating and communicating that remediation, it's the same deal. It's just OFAC has labeled these people as, you know, engaged in activity, which they consider to be malign. Let's leave it at that.
Yep. Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on. It was great talking to you about delisting. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, great talking to you. Thanks for having me on. It's fun.
All right. Yeah, no, it's great. Thanks for listening, everybody, and stay sanctions free.
Produced by Heartcast Media.